Hey, good morning, everybody. Let's go ahead and we'll get started even though we're a few seconds early. So I hope you all had a good weekend. I'm going to pick up where we had left off last week, and I'm going to go over just a little bit again what we've already gone over. We're looking at the TOCO, so you'll have to forgive me as we kind of just backtrack just a moment because there were a couple of things I probably should have brought up on Friday that I didn't. So let's see. Some of you went to CPAC, right? Nana, would you go?
Yeah.
How was it?
It was fun.
Yeah? Good. I'm glad they denied Richard Spencer. Was that a big deal at the conference, or was it more just outside of the conference we heard about it?
Probably more outside.
Okay. All right. Well, I'd love to hear about it sometime. Yeah. You know, things went good. All right. Well, so I want to talk about de Tocqueville, and in particular, I want to talk about his reasons for coming over. And you've had now, I think, at least a good introduction here for his massive two-volume History of Democracy in America. You have just these selections in your reader, and we'll look at them really closely. But if you remember, as I had talked about last week, Alexis de Tocqueville, I think three things speak in his favor, at least as he's trying to understand America. So he's an aristocrat, he's a Roman Catholic, and he's French, meaning he's not American, and in almost every way. Right? He's not a commoner, he's not a Protestant, and he's not Anglo-Saxon. And yet, he has that incredible Anglophilia. He certainly has, in so many ways, a love of what's going on in America. And I think part of that comes out in his understanding of the English tradition and through Edmund Burke and Adam Smith and David Hume and the Scottish Enlightenment in particular. But he's very interested in things like the common law. And he's interested in the formation of communities. So when de Tocqueville comes over, remember he's barely older than you guys are, when he comes over, he does so, and this is what I didn't talk about last week, he does so by getting a grant from the king. And the grant is not what we would think of where he's given money. Instead, this was during the Restoration in France after the French Revolution, after Napoleon. So it's a very conservative, reactionary time. The king now has a lot of power, the restored king. And when he gives a grant to de Tocqueville, it just means he gives his blessing that de Tocqueville can leave the country and come to America. And what de Tocqueville, me and his best friend Charles Beaumont, which you'll forgive me if you speak French, I'm obviously saying it terribly, so I'll just let you and your mind do your great French accent there. Mine would end up sounding like a really bad Peter Sellers, so it would not be worth me doing. But he and Charles came over as best friends in their mid-20s. And the reason they were given a grant by the king was because they said they were going to study American prison systems. And that seems absurd to us in 2017, where we have the most incarcerated percentage of the population in prison of any people in the world. But in the 1820s and 30s, our prison system was regarded as the ideal prison system in the world. And it was seen as the model for anyone who was trying to rehabilitate criminals. So when de Tocqueville told the king this is what he was going to do, the king was all for it because everybody wanted to figure out what we were doing right in the 1820s and 30s with our criminal reform. Part of it was just, well, we don't have to get into this. It was simply that, you know, our criminals generally went west. So they could keep moving on the frontier. They weren't locked up in cities, I think, as we'll see later on. But that's something we can talk about at another time. So de Tocqueville's ostensible reason for coming over is to study prison systems. But as we've seen, the moment he gets over here, even though he does do that, that he doesn't neglect his duty to the king. But his real interest is looking at American democracy. And he uses the terms democracy and equality synonymously. So let me point out just a couple of things, some of which you have in your readings. We'll go over these in great detail, and some which you don't. But I think all of which are important to understand de Tocqueville. So as I mentioned last week, in his two-volume History of America, so Democracy, published 1835, Volume 1, and then 1840, Volume 2, in these two books, de Tocqueville gives us probably the single best look we ever have had or ever will have about what it means to be an American. It is not a celebration of America, though he is willing to celebrate America where he thinks America has done well. But that's not his goal here. He is not trying to celebrate America. He is trying to observe America. And in particular, as I talked about last week, he wants to figure out what it is specifically that God has determined for the world, which will play out in America. So in de Tocqueville's religious. I don't want you to think of him, though, as kind of a Bible thumper. So he hasn't had a revelation. This is all intellectual for him. I don't want you to think he thinks of himself as a prophet and God told him to do this. That's not the case at all. This isn't like Tao. So as de Tocqueville sees it, he simply studied the world. Again, he's a young man, but he studied the world, and he believes firmly that we're moving into this egalitarian, democratic, equalitarian age. And that's God's will. But we get to choose, as agents with free will, we get to choose how that will play out. So three things de Tocqueville says that I want you to know specifically overall. So number one, just restating what I've said, and that is for de Tocqueville, the move towards equality is a providential fact. In the readings you have, he says it's a primary fact. But in a reading we don't have, which is just right after the introduction, you guys know you have just snippets, he says this is a providential fact. It's a providential fact that we are moving into this new world that God has so determined, but we get to determine how to shape that. So that's number one. Number two, de Tocqueville thinks that democracy overall is a good thing, but he's very hesitant to embrace it fully because he thinks it has very serious flaws. So the reason it has flaws has to do with the fall of man. And with the fall of man, he believes that it will be very hard for any of us to celebrate the greatness of each other, but rather will desire to make everybody equal at a low level. So that's the big problem with democracy. And yet, it's not bad. You know, we think about democracy, what it does, the idea that we can raise people up. If we could actually have a democracy that works, de Tocqueville is very much in favor of it. He's just skeptical we can make it work. The third thing he does, and this is where it gets, I think, probably a little sticky in our day and age, and it wouldn't have been that much less sticky in his day and age, but he's not politically correct at all when he talks about race. So one of the major problems he sees in America is what he calls the problem of the three races. And by the three races, he means the American Indian, the European, and the black. So these three peoples, he says, these are the peoples that make up America, and whites have a very strange vision towards the other two. And his argument, so he makes two arguments about this. So race is always going to be a problem for us. But he says, number one, about the Indians, that he's never in any way, and he's stunned by this, and he's horrified too, he's never seen a people more properly and legally destroy another people as we've done with the American Indian. He says that the way the Europeans treat the American Indian, all the language is good. It's all, yes, we admire the Indian, we believe that we need to save the man and kill the redness of the Indian, that was language at the time. And yet all of this, even though we do it all through democratic language, we're actually crushing a people. And this worries de Tocqueville to no end, not only because he thinks it's horrible what we're doing to the Indian, but he also thinks that it's dramatically infecting our own understanding of ourselves. So we're lying, basically. We say we believe in freedom as we're just crushing these people. And we keep calling out freedom, 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 and we're crushing these people. So he says we're making ourselves, and we probably don't even realize we're doing it, we're just making ourselves total hypocrites. And we're destroying the very meaning of liberty. So I'm going to read to you just briefly. We don't have this in... Actually, I'm going to jump forward, then I'll come back and read. Sorry, I'm a little scattered this morning. Okay, so on blacks, let me do that since we're on the race issue, and that's a little bit easier to explain. De Tocqueville's argument about blacks is the one that Lincoln will have to use later on, 30 years later. His argument is that, and it's one we've already talked about, but it's the argument that if whites ever simply grant blacks the freedom, blacks will be utterly resentful forever. Because the tradition must be that they must reclaim their freedom for themselves. However, if they do that, it will only be done through violence, and then whites will hate blacks forever. So this is a real catch-22 for race in America. And he's very fearful. He doesn't believe that even if we figure out a solution to the race problem, that there will always be racial tensions in America forever, that this is not something that will ever go away. It may wax and wane, but we will always have these problems. There will always be one resentment or another going one direction or another. So that's a permanent problem for him. And I have to admit, I don't as politically incorrect as it is, there may be an argument there. It's going to take a lot of work for both sides, whites and blacks, I think, to really overcome a lot of the anger that's there. And we can cast blame, and certainly whites are to blame for enslaving, but it's stickier than that, obviously, and far more complicated. So, but I think de Tocqueville has a point. This is going to be an obvious problem for a very long time, and we're going to have to really, really look at that. Okay, so let's go back to the Indian for a moment, because de Tocqueville doesn't believe the Indian's going to survive. Blacks will survive. Indians will not. So they're on their way out. So as this race, their importance for de Tocqueville in some ways is more important than how he explains blacks, because the Indians on their way out. And if we don't learn from what we've done to them, then we're going to miss a fundamental aspect of human liberty and dignity. So this is the problem. Here's what he writes. This, by the way, this is just in his, it's called The Problem of the Three Races in America in Volume 1. You don't have any of this. This isn't in your selection. It is impossible to conceive the extent of the sufferings which attend these forced immigrations of the Indians, what we would call the Trail of Tears, the movement of the civilized tribes in the South to Oklahoma. They are undertaken by a people already exhausted and reduced, and the countries to which the inhabitants betake themselves are already settled by other tribes which receive them with generous hostility. So imagine, let's say you're a member of the Cherokee, or the Chickasaw, or the Creek, or the Choctaw tribes. And you have, and this is, I don't know if you guys have read this in Tyndall yet, or if you know this from other things, but the tribes tended to be, these tribes, especially those four tribes, but the Cherokee and Choctaw preeminent, they tended to have their own Republican constitutions, they had their own newspapers, they had their own schools and universities. They had really, really bought into very clearly, and it was native to them actually, but they had bought into the forms of European republicanism. And in many ways, the Choctaw were far more small-R Republican than their white neighbors, far more. They were actually living a serious republic in the way that we probably hadn't seen since maybe one of the Greek city-states was flourishing. So you've got almost these classical peoples living among the Indians in the South. But they also, something we don't often talk about, they also as Southerners, held more slaves per capita than even whites did. So there was a lot of jealousy among the whites towards the Indians in the South, because the Indians had all this good land. They were wealthier than the whites. They had more slaves than the whites. And the whites were pretty jealous. So if we wanted to look at a people, they've done everything we've asked them to do, and yet it's still not good enough. We remove them out to the West. So if you take a Cherokee and you force him by bayonet point to remove him from, say, Alabama out to Oklahoma, you know, imagine what that would be like. First of all, you're being taken from your home, and you're moving. Anybody who's been to Alabama, and I'm not a huge fan of the South, but I'm not from the South either. Now, Alabama's soil is good. It's a little too good for my taste, and you've got, you know, all that Spanish moss growing everywhere. It's just too much growth for me. But imagine going from that to Oklahoma, where you don't have trees growing, you've got tornadoes. In the winter, it's negative 40. In the summer, it's 110. It was this totally different environment. And the idea of Jackson was, well, look, they're all Indians. Just put them together. Well, when some Cherokee shows up and his name is Andrew McAndrews, and he's the chief of this subtribe of the Cherokees, and he meets Yellow Feather of the Comanche, the Comanche is not going to say, ah, my yellow brother or my red brother. I mean, he just thinks this is a white guy who happens to be somewhat dark-complected, and he's an enemy on his soil. So those guys who were forcibly removed by the United States, who are very civilized, more civilized than we are, forced to remove to Oklahoma, when they get there, they find that the Indians there hate them. And of course they would. I mean, how could they not? They're intruders. So this is in every way. I don't know if you guys know this. This is a statistic you have to know. So of the civilized tribes, each of them had about 18,000 members. So not total, but each of the great southern tribes, so the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Creek, they each had about 18,000 to 20,000 members. In the forced removal, so when they're pushed by bayonet point to move to Oklahoma, they lose about one out of every three people. It is horrible. Can you imagine if we just cut this classroom, that third of the class I just kicked out, you guys are all dead. And that's amazing to think about, that one out of every three. But then when they get to Oklahoma, all the provisions that had been promised them, because they arrive in the winter, that the U.S. government said would be there, are not there. There's no food. There's no lumber. This is the treeless Great Plains. And the winter's horrible. They have no medicines, nothing. They lose another one out of every two people at that point. So within about a year, each of these southern tribes loses two-thirds of their population. This is incredible. This is just horrific. This is far greater in terms of percentage, in terms of killing a people. This is far greater than even, say, the Jews during the Holocaust camps. So this is very, very high in terms of percentages. So this is a brutal thing. And this, it's understandable that a great kind of Republican slash liberal like de Tocqueville would be horrified by this. And he says this is going to taint us forever. We'll always feel guilty about this, especially when we realize what we've done. So he says, "Hunger is in the rear, war awaits them, misery besets them on all sides. In the hope of escaping from such a host of enemies, they separate each individual and endeavors to procure the means of supporting his existence, but in solitude and secrecy, living in the immensity of the desert like an outcast from civilized life. The social tie, which distress had long since weakened, is then dissolved. They have not only lost their country, they soon have lost their very community and their people. Their families are obliterated. Their names they bore are forgotten. Their language perishes, and all traces of their origins disappear." In other words, they become a non-people. They become nothing. So we've just erased them out of existence. And de Tocqueville ends this chapter, and I hope you guys have to understand this is all incredible sarcasm in the way he puts this. He says, "The Spaniards were unable to exterminate the Indian race by those unparalleled atrocities which brand them with indelible shame, nor did they ever succeed in fully depriving the Indians of their rights. But the Americans of the United States have accomplished this twofold purpose, destruction as well as denying them their rights, with a singular ferocity. Tranquility, they have done it legally. They have done it with the language of philanthropy. They have rarely shed blood. They have never in their own eyes violated a single principle of their morality. It is impossible to destroy men with more respect for the laws of humanity than what the Americans have done to the Indians." So at every stage, we've had good language, good propaganda. We've hardly ever killed an Indian outright, and yet we've destroyed them. And that, de Tocqueville says, will haunt us forever. We will never overcome this. This will be the great tainting of the American people that we will have to deal with this when we kind of wake up and realize what we've done. So that, is everybody clear on what the races are and how he sees these, why they're important? So blacks, a permanent problem. Indians, a temporary problem, but temporary because of the way we're even using great language of natural rights, we're killing them. So is that everybody clear on that? You don't have to agree with de Tocqueville, but I think his evidence is pretty compelling. Okay, so let's look at what he says then in the readings that you actually have. So let's go back to these, or go to them, and let's see what page are we on. Let's go to, we are on 295, right, is the beginning, but let's jump forward a little bit. Let's go to, okay, we got good stuff on family, principle of sovereignty, unlimited power. All right, we're going to jump forward quite a bit. Let's go to page 310. Would somebody read here? "So a distinction must be drawn between tyranny and arbitrary power." Shiloh, thanks. How are you feeling? Are you better?
Yeah.
Good. Glad you hear it.
How far are you up to go?
I'm going to have you read that whole section, and then we'll probably go on to how it exercised.
Okay.
Thank you.
"A distinction must be drawn between tyranny and arbitrary power. Tyranny may be exercised by means of the law, and in that case, it is not arbitrary. Arbitrary power may be exercised for the good of the community at large, in which case, it is not tyrannical. Tyranny usually employs arbitrary means, but if necessary, it can rule without them. In the United States, the unbounded power of a majority, which is favorable to the legal despotism of the legislature, is likewise favorable to the arbitrary authority of the magistrate. The majority has an entire control over the law when it is made and when it is executed. and as it possesses an equal authority over those who are in power and the community at large, it considers public officers as its passive agents and readily confides the task of serving its designs to their vigilance. The details of their office and the privileges which they are to enjoy are rarely defined beforehand, but the majority treats them as a master does his servants, when they are always at work in his sight, and he has the power of directing or reprimanding them at every instant. In general, the American functionaries are far more independent than the French civil officers within the sphere which is prescribed to them. Sometimes even, they are allowed by the popular authority to exceed those bounds, but as they are protected by the opinion and backed by the cooperation of the majority, they venture upon such manifestations of their power as astonish a European. By this means, habits are formed in the heart of the country, which may someday prove fatal to its liberties.
Okay, thanks, Cheryl. You have a nice reading voice. All right, so what do we have here? This is the great question. So we often think of democracy as a mechanism, just majority rule. And de Tocqueville is saying, very importantly in this section, that the question is not a mere mechanism. It becomes a spirit. That is, we're not looking at what just leads A to B, but what happens between A and B. What's the connection here? So we in America, we love to say things like, we the people, or the power resides, sovereignty resides in the people. But what de Tocqueville says is that it's very, very easy to mistake the mechanism for the spirit and the spirit for the mechanism. So whereas we may think that democracy is a good thing because we all get to vote and we have a say, by all of us getting to vote and having a say, we also politicize everything. So in the way that we can say, well, we the people believe in this, it's very easy to substitute the will of the majority for the rule of law. We forget the rule of law. And so I'm sure you've all heard this saying before, and this is before de Tocqueville, but de Tocqueville is expressing this. We start thinking that the will of the people is an expression of the will of God, and the will of God expresses himself through the will of the people. So what's the difference here? Well, if a democracy tries to have a majority rule, even if it says it will protect the rights of the minority, it almost always becomes so intensely self-righteous by proclaiming itself as the voice of the people that everybody else really becomes subsumed under that. And it becomes very difficult in the long run for minorities of any kind, racial, political, ethnic, whatever they may be, it becomes very difficult in the democracy for them to maintain their independence because they are seen as some subset and therefore not representative of the will of the whole. So the problem for us, de Tocqueville says, is we like to think that the synonym of democracy is freedom. It actually is probably more totalitarian than it is freedom because it likes to think of itself as a totality, not necessarily totalitarian in the sense that I take Marina in a Stalinist regime and I crush her unless she decides to be exactly like me or exactly like Stalin. But it's totalitarian in a different way. It's more that maybe Shelby and I pressure her and keep pressuring her, and then we get Nicole and Natalie, and we start really putting a lot of pressure on her not to think differently, but to think like us. And we become actually offended after a while when she thinks independently because we're so concerned with the democracy. We become so concerned with how we think that we start forgetting that there are minorities and that there are subsets. This is, for de Tocqueville, the great difference between the spirit of a democracy, which tends towards totalitarianism, and the spirit of a republic, which tends towards community and small sufficiency as opposed to one community. So this would be the difference. Democracy promotes the greater good, as opposed to a republic, which promotes the common good. These are very different things. They may sound alike, and they may even have some overlap, but one is correct, that is the common good. The other is a destruction of the good. It's a perversion of the good. So the greater good presumes that we will have winners and losers, whereas the common good presumes we all give up a little bit for all of us to benefit. So the republic is the common good. The democrat or democracy is the greater good. but democracy's real leaning is towards totalitarianism, simply because of the spirit of things and because of the kind of community pressure. So it's not enough to imagine it as a mere mechanism for de Tocqueville. It is instead a kind of way of life, and it does try and subsume all things. That's why, and I'll get you just a second, Natalie, that's why if we go back to the beginning, when he says, well, what does this new democracy do? It creates habits, it forms opinions, it creates laws, only in the way that religion had once done. So democracy becomes a kind of form of religion. None of us would expect, I assume, any of us who are religious, we would presume that religion by its very nature is totalitarian. That is, it wants to have the totality of us. There shouldn't be aspects of our life that are religious and aspects that are not. If you're religious, it needs to pervade your whole life. Now politics is taking that place for de Tocqueville. Democracy has become a new religion. We may not even recognize it. It's just the way it acts and the way we treat it. We have a reverence for it in the way people once had a reverence for Christianity. So they become really, it's a replacement. Natalie.
So would you say that de Tocqueville is discussing the totalitarian nature of democracy in more of a cautionary sense, or do you think he's recognizing those problems in America already and pointing them out?
Well, he does see a few now, mm-hmm. right? So he's talking about even in America, mm-hmm. the kinds of things that a magistrate would never, ever do in Europe because they would see limitations. The American, in the name of freedom, will do it because they think, well, I've got the will of the democracy behind him, but it's not there yet. So it's only happening in small circumstances, but it's the trend. Right? So everything for de Tocqueville's not concerned with tomorrow as much as he's concerned with next century. So he's always giving us a long-run view here. But let me put it this way. Natalie, this is a great question. I'll try and explain this in the way that de Tocqueville would think of it. A republic, by its very nature, is a limited government, because it relies so much on the will of individuals and communities. Democracy, though, relies on the will of everybody as a whole. In a republic, therefore, we would never, ever imagine that laws should deal with, that laws would deal with what's going on in the classroom. This is a private thing. We've all agreed to be here. I've agreed to be your professor. You've agreed to be my student. You've all taken that oath to the Platonic God and to Dave Whalen and Dr. Arne. And we know what that is. And we're all here because we want to be here. No one comes to Hillsdale because they're forced to come here. So in a republic, we've already presumed that through our free will, we've made this choice. What he's saying is that in a democracy, you start thinking, well, look, if we want everybody to kind of think as a whole, as a group, then why not pass laws that deal with education? Because that affects all of us. What I'm teaching in this classroom, what Laurel's learning, is not just going to affect what she does in the lunchroom today. It's going to affect what she does in the business she starts, or in the school she starts, or in the family she has, or in her community. And therefore, it affects all of us. So democracy says it's okay to politicize all things. If we want to politicize education, that's fine, because it affects everybody. If we want to politicize commerce, that's fine, because it affects everybody. Think about how often the Commerce Clause is used as an excuse for Congress to have an influence on all things. And that's the difference between a democracy, which may use the language of freedom, but in its trajectory, in its trend, it moves us towards politicizing all things. So nothing becomes off limits. And that, what a huge difference between a de Tocqueville, born in 1805, and a Marx, born in 1809. 4 years difference. But now Marx is thinking everything should be political. And that's, de Tocqueville is suggesting that democracy is not as free, not as oriented towards freedom as we like to think it is. It is, in fact, much more oriented towards the politicization of life and therefore the totalitarianization. That's really awkward, sorry, but making all things a part of the totality. Natalie, does that help? Okay, so things, what was once private becomes public. And that's what democracy does. And yet it does it in a good way, or at least it pretends it does. It believes it does. Yeah, if I can say the will of the people, well, then what's wrong with that? This is what the people want. So it must be good. And that's the excuse. That's the argument. And that's where, that's no different than saying, well, God said we had to do it that way. Right? That becomes the same kind of argument. So, Katarina.
Does, what did the Tocqueville say that, like, the conflation of democracy with republicanism could potentially be, like, the end of the American Republic? Or, like, how does he see, I know that we discussed in the beginning of class, like, America is destined to become this democratic society along with, like, the Western world. And how does you see the preservation of republicanism in light of that?
Well, that's what we got to get to. And so he does, and this is, again, a great question, Katarina. We've got to think about how he's viewing this. So there are, remember, this is the trend. It's not absolute. It is a warning. He's giving us a warning of what's happening. So as Natalie suggested, there are parts where he can already see it happening. But it's not yet everything. So what he says, and we'll get to this in a little bit, not quite yet. But he does say we do one thing better than any other people anywhere in the history of the world. And that will save, it's the only thing that will save us. And that thing is we do create communities very well. Whatever that, whether it's a community to stop drinking, excessive drinking, so maybe a society for temperance, or it's a society to help the homeless, or it's a society to distribute books, whatever it is, de Tocqueville says, we do this brilliantly. That will be our only salvation. But if we lose the habit of creating communities, then we're done. So as long as we keep that, though, we'll prevent this democracy from becoming totalitarian. But it's iffy. He's very skeptical we'll be able to do that in the long run. So does that help?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so let's jump forward again. Shiloh, would you mind reading a little bit more?
Sure.
We're going to jump forward. So you've got this idea here on 310. We're going to jump, or 311, 310, 311. I'm going to jump forward now to 327. And if you don't mind, Shiloh, I'll have you read just right there, second full paragraph.
Freedom has appeared.
Yeah, and I'll stop you.
Okay.
Everybody see that? So we're on 327, line 7.
Freedom has appeared in the world at different times and under various forms. It has not been exclusively bound to any social condition, and it is not confined to democracies. Freedom cannot, therefore, form the distinguishing characteristic of democratic ages. The peculiar and preponderating fact which marks those ages as its own is the equality of conditions. The ruling passion of men in those periods is the love of this equality. Ask not what singular charm the men of democratic ages find in being equal, or what special reasons they may have for clinging so tenaciously to equality, rather than to the other advantages which society holds out to them. Equality is the distinguishing characteristic of the age they live in, that of itself is enough to explain that they prefer it to all the rest. But independently of this reason, there are several others which will, at all times, habitually lead men to prefer equality to freedom. If a people could ever succeed in destroying, or even in diminishing, the equality which prevails in its own body, this could only be accomplished by long and laborious efforts. Its social condition must be modified, its laws abolished, its opinions superseded, its habits changed, its manners corrupted. But political liberty is more easily lost. To neglect to hold it fast is to allow it to escape. Men, therefore, not only cling to equality because it is dear to them, they also adhere to it because they think it will last forever. That political freedom may compromise in its excesses the tranquility, the property, the lives of individuals is obvious to the narrowest and the most unthinking minds. But on the contrary, none but attentive and clear-sighted men perceive the perils with which equality threatens us, and they commonly avoid pointing them out. They know that the calamities they apprehend are remote, and flatter themselves that they will only fall upon future generations, for which the present generation takes but little thought. The evils which freedom sometimes brings with it are immediate. They are apparent to all, and all are more or less affected by them. The evils which extreme equality may produce are slowly disclosed. They creep gradually into the social frame. They are only seen at intervals, and at the moment at which they become most violent, habit already causes them to be no longer felt.
Good. Let's stop there, Shiloh. Thank you. Very well read. So this is a hard thing for us because we live in a moment of extreme equality. And here we are. Tocqueville's right. We moved into this position. And he says we tend, again, we conflate. What was the word you used?
Conflate.
Yeah, that was a perfect word. I should have used that earlier. So we conflate these things. democracy and republic, and we do that all the time. Nobody refers, unless you're the most hardcore reactionary right winger, nobody refers to America as the republic anymore. Yeah, maybe Hillsdale, we do, but that's most people, you know, this is a democracy. When we say democracy, it's like that good feeling right here. It's like saying love or peace or Jesus or, you know, Buddha. Yeah, so we get all that right here. And that democracy, you know, republic actually even sounds kind of hardcore. But democracy is kind of soft and voluptuous, and we like it, and it's spread everywhere. So that's what de Tocqueville is saying here. And I love this. This is actually, for what it's worth, this page that you're reading right now. When I first read this in college, this totally changed my life. This one page, and then right after what Shiloh read, the next section here, this, it made me realize something that I'd not realized before. You know, imagine Western heritage. Every single time liberties have been gained, it's because somebody was willing to go out and die for them. Every single time. Whether it's Leonidas in the 300 at Thermopylae, or whether it's Cicero who accepts martyrdom, or Socrates who accepts martyrdom. But every time you have this amazing moment, or the aristocrats restraining King John for the Magna Carta, you always have this pressure by a small group of people upon the leader, forcing him to give up his power so that there can be rights recognized. And so this is what de Tocqueville says. It comes sporadically. Freedom is very, very rare because it always has to be earned. Whereas equality is this thing that we just have to pass a piece of legislation. And if we do that, then everybody kind of benefits. And we can actually point to it. We can point to, look, this bill was passed. Here's the Social Security Act passed in 1933. Look what it did. It allowed for all senior citizens to have health insurance and so forth. And therefore, yeah, we see the equality. We can point to it and we can see the benefits of it. We don't see the downside. We don't see that it's denying banks a certain amount of money circulating so that they can invest it. It's not. We don't see that it's taking from somebody who maybe is trying to start a small business but can't because they just had this taken away from them, not called a tax, but instead their FICA. And it's taken away, and now we don't see that. What we see is, here is an elderly person. It's all good, we don't want our elderly people to die, certainly, but here's an elderly person who had not saved or had lost their money. Now they're being given, through equality, these benefits. We can show all that. So we don't see the costs, we only see the kind of happy results. Here's a person who's not dying in the gutter, which, believe me, is good. We don't want people dying in the gutter. But we don't see all the costs that are associated with it as well. And de Tocqueville says, we don't often focus then on what we can't see. We only focus on what we're seeing, and we focus on the results, but not how we necessarily got there. So in my lifetime, you guys would not have seen this, but in my lifetime, one of the most interesting things was 1989. We'll talk about this at the end of the class, at the end of the semester. But if we get to 1989, this incredible moment where before at least December of 1989, you have one communist country after another collapsing and really becoming free without a single shot being fired. This is one of the most amazing moments in all of world history. By the time you get to Christmas, the Romanians are massacring each other. But up until Christmas, there's poor Christmas, right? Up until December, it's a completely violent, free rebellion where all of these communist powers fall down. Now, in theory, in 1989, everybody in a communist world is at this level, right? We're just going to make an arbitrary level here. They're all relatively equal, unless, of course, you're a ruler, then you're way up here. But most people are somewhere right in here. Then all of a sudden, there's freedom. And we've seen this in Poland. We've seen this in the Czech Republic. We've seen it in East Germany to a lesser extent. But all these places where you have freedom, suddenly, let's pick a good German, Hans, who was just, regular guy in 1989, in 1990, when it's all free, radically free, Hans does really, really, really well. And he's seen an opportunity right here. He can start the Quickie Mart, or he can do whatever on the corner, which he wasn't allowed to do before, and he's really, really successful. Whereas Gertrude, and I'm not trying to be sexist here, it's just the name that popped into my head, whereas Gertrude has... she was really reliant upon the benefits of the state. Now they're gone, and she goes into poverty. Well, it doesn't mean that Hans is better than Gertrude. What it means is, at that moment when there's freedom, Hans saw an opportunity that worked, he took it, and he succeeded. Gertrude didn't see an opportunity, maybe wasn't even conditioned to see an opportunity, and therefore she's failed. 30 years later, well, who knows where they are? Maybe Gertrude now has her own candle-making, maybe, you know, scented candles for Eastern European fraus. You know, and this is great for bath time, and she's doing extremely well. Hans couldn't keep up with, you know, the price changes in petroleum and couldn't handle the taxes, so he's down here. But the point is, when you have equality, you can see, obviously, everybody is at the same level. But once you create freedom, people are at radically different levels. It doesn't mean they'll stay there. It means that the opportunity, their skills, and the time worked perfectly so they could either do something or could not. But the next day, it may be different. So this is what de Tocqueville says. I can look to 1988 Germany, and yeah, it's all gray, but everybody's equal. They're all equal, totally equal. Whereas 2 years later, I see extremes of wealth and poverty. Doesn't mean they'll stay that way, but that's what happens. And that's de Tocqueville's argument. We forget what's happening here. And it's so much easier. If I could put all of you in a box, if I could just say, yeah, look at all of you. You're all just like this. I know you're going to behave this way. I just give you all B's for the whole class. I never have to grade. We'll just go straight. We're going to make everybody totally equal in here. Not even B pluses, B minus. I mean, how easy would that be for me? It'd be incredible, right? I could come in and I could do my little acting spiel and have fun and walk around and throw things. And then at the end, I just put B, 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 and it's all done. And we go home. You're somewhat happy. I'm really happy because I didn't have to work. But think about how easy that would be. Think about how hard it is when I have to judge you. I have to grade you. I have to say, all right, here's what Abby did in the blue book. She did a great job, but on the paper, by the way, I'm just kidding, putting it on the paper in this paragraph, so I've got to balance those things. That's hard. And I've also got to recognize that you're all different. I've got to recognize you come to me with different gifts. You come to me with different strengths, different weaknesses. I have strengths and weaknesses. Maybe my weakness makes Laurel weaker. Maybe my strength makes her stronger. I have to judge all of that. And that's just part of life. And it's, de Tocqueville says, with something like equality, isn't it easy just to say, yeah, we're just all right here. That's it. There's no differentiation, no distinction. Billy and Janie, they're exactly the same. Well, they're not. Billy's not even sure who he is. Janie's not sure who she is. They're trying to figure all of this out. Life is complicated. And de Tocqueville says, basically, freedom is the only ideal that allows for mystery and complication. Equality, just, it's too easy. Maybe it's good. We should, at certain levels, treat people equally. But we also have to recognize those differences in total sense. So, okay, somebody else want to read Shiloh? You did a great job. Thank you. But let's go from here. So the advantages. Nicole, would you mind?
Sure. The advantages which freedom brings are only shown by length of time, and it is always easy to mistake the cause in which they originate. The advantages of equality are instantaneous, and they may constantly be traced from their source. Political liberty bestows exalted pleasures from time to time upon a certain number of citizens. Equality every day confers a number of small enjoyments on every man. The charms of equality are every instant felt and are within the reach of all. The noblest hearts are not insensible to them, and the most vulgar souls exalt them. The passion which equality engenders must therefore be at once strong and general. Men cannot enjoy political liberty unpurchased by some sacrifices, and they never obtain it without great exertions. But the pleasures of equality are self-proffered. Each of the petty incidents of life seems to occasion them, and in order to taste them, nothing is required but to live. Democratic nations are at all times fond of equality, but there are certain ethics at which the passion they entertain for it swells to the height of fury. This occurs at the moment when the old social system, long menaced, completes its own destruction after a last intestine struggle, and when the barriers of rank are at length thrown down. At such times, men pounce upon equality as their booty, and they cling to it as to some precious treasure which they fear to lose. The passion for equality penetrates on every side into men's hearts, expands there, and fills them entirely. Not that by this blind surrender of themselves to an exclusive power they risk their dearest interests, they are deaf. Show them not freedom escaping from their grasp whilst they are looking another way. They are blind, or rather they can discern but one sole object to be desired in the universe. What I have said is applicable to all democratic nations. What I am about to say concerns the French alone. Amongst most modern nations, and especially amongst all those of the continent of Europe, the taste and the idea of freedom only began to exist and to extend itself at the time when social conditions were tending to equality, and as a consequence of that very equality. Absolute kings were the most efficient levelers of ranks amongst their subjects. Amongst these nations, equality preceded freedom. Equality was therefore a fact of some standing when freedom was still a novelty. The one had already created customs, opinions, and laws belonging to it when the other, alone and for the first time, came into actual existence. Thus, the latter was still only an affair of opinion and of taste, whilst the former had already crept into the habits of the people, possessed itself of their manners, and given a particular turn to the smallest actions in their lives. Can it be wondered that the men of our own time prefer the one to the other? I think that democratic communities have a natural taste for freedom. Left to themselves, they will seek it, cherish it, and view any privation of it with regret. But for equality, their passion is ardent, insatiable, incessant, invincible. They call for equality and freedom, and if they cannot obtain that, they still call for equality and slavery. They will endure poverty, servitude, barbarism, but they will not endure aristocracy.
Okay, thanks, Nicole. Well read. So this is the, and he's throwing the gauntlet down here. This is the problem. So we may profess freedom, but in fact, if we have to choose between freedom and equality, we would much rather we all be equal in slavery than someone be better than us. So when he says at the end there, they will endure poverty, servitude, barbarism, but they will not endure aristocracy, you could easily scratch out aristocracy and write excellence, because that's exactly what he means here. They will not allow for real excellence. And it's hard to disagree with him. I think we still, as Americans, we have a great taste for excellence and for freedom. But you can imagine, there have been moments recently where you're all number one, everybody gets a participation medal. You know, these are all things de Tocqueville would have just cringed, but he also would have predicted that we're trying to soften competition. We're trying to make it less. And we do so because of feelings and it's emotions. We don't do so because it's rational. We do so because it's something that feels good. We want to make sure that everybody feels that they are a part of this. So that's a gauntlet moment. Right? We'll throw this down, but obviously we'll prefer slavery to excellence. And that's brutal. So I just pulled this up. Nicole, I hope my typing didn't bother you when you were reading. But I didn't mean to bring this up. But I just immediately thought, I love... One of my favorite poems is Ulysses by Tennyson. And as he was writing there saying, you know, equality gives us these daily little pleasures, right? Whereas freedom, you only get every once in a while. I just immediately thought of where Ulysses says to his son, forever and forever, then and move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life, life merely piled on life. I love that, is if that's enough just to breathe. But you know, as he says later on, we were men who strove with gods. Let us do something before the end. And I love that. I mean, maybe that's the romantic side of me, but to me that is crucial, that we have to pursue that kind of excellence. Okay, we've only got 2 minutes left, but does anybody have any final questions? Otherwise, okay, make sure you read that next section there to the end, so you're right on the remarks of Seneca Falls. But read of individualism in democratic countries. We're going to pick that up. And I want to get to Katerina's question about what can we do to prevent this? And is there a possibility? So I do want to give you another reading assignment for Wednesday. I would ask that you read... Let's see, did I have you guys read Jackson yet, the first annual message?
No.
Okay, read that. And then also read Seneca Falls, The Letter from the Alamo, and The Great Nature of Futurity. None of those are long. So Jackson, Stanton, Travis, and O'Sullivan. Okay? For Wednesday? Great. Thanks, everybody. Have a good Monday and Tuesday. Stay healthy. Enjoy the sun. We're supposed to have snow tomorrow, so make sure, or rain, so make sure you enjoy the sun today. Yeah, it's snow and rain, I think, next thunderstorm.
Oh!
Good. February. Thunder. Travis and Unsold.
Yeah,
just so those four readings, they're really short. I think Stan is the longest. It's probably the one I spend the least time on, too. But. Yeah, no problem. I'll make sure I record it.
Cool. Thanks for letting me know.